Hello, my name is Alexander Clark, and welcome to the first in Batch 2 of the Falkland series of podcasts. This is a series which moves on from the first series in that it looks at the air war. And we are starting with Steve George, an air engineering officer who was key to keeping our aircraft going down in the Falklands, and who has had a lustrous career since, including working on the F-35 project, for which he's already done a podcast with us in the past. In fact, it was the first podcast for the East Atlantic series. I hope you enjoy and find tonight's podcast useful. It was very interesting to record, and it was certainly an experience which I will always treasure. Steve is an engaging and very interesting man who can really explain the engineering very well. Anyway, that's enough for me. Enjoy.
SimSec brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SimSec is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There's a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SimSec article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SimSec is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
What went through your mind when you heard about the war? When you heard about the Falklands War starting?
The start of the war for me was a call at home. We were on leave. The squadron was on leave. And, I was out in the back garden digging a huge hole in the Cornish mud to replace a fence post. And my wife, called me and said, Steve, it's the senior observer. And, he said, get into the squadron and start recalling people. And really all we'd seen is we'd seen a very occasional thing about the South Georgia scrap thing going on. And then there'd been, you know, so a couple of things that they'd actually invaded, and of course the news was breaking. So we were kind of expecting something to happen, but we had no idea what. So when I got the call from the senior observer, this was, okay, now I'm going to find out what. And of course I didn't find out what for about another week or so. The first thing was just get back on board. So it was quite routine. It was, okay, we've been called, let's go.
Okay. And how well prepared did you feel for war?
What, me personally or the unit?
You and the unit.
Okay. Well, me personally, exceptionally well prepared. The Royal Navy's aircraft engineer training is outstandingly good. By that time, I had over 21 months of specialist training post-degree. I'd then gone and done a 5-month brutal certificate of competency training at Yeovilton. I'd gone down to Caldros 2 years before, and I'd done time on a search and rescue squadron, then on a seeking training squadron. Then I joined H-20, which was a squadron I went down south with in June 81. And then we spent most of 81 working up. So by that time, I was pretty experienced on the aircraft. I knew how a squadron worked. The thing I didn't have was how one of the Invincible class, well, by that time, by April 82, we pretty much knew how the ship worked as well. So me personally, reasonably well equipped. The squadron and the ship was pretty well worked up by that time.
Okay. So, what were the, as you said, you were ashore. Mm-hmm. So you're on lead. So what were the problems with organizing, especially from an engineering perspective, which I presume the amount of stores you take once you know you're going to war versus when mm-hmm. you're going on a normal trip probably alters a little bit. Mm-hmm. What were the challenges from going to this shore rest leave period to mm-hmm. being on the ship going down south?
That's a really good question. I want to explain my role. I was the deputy aircraft engineering officer on a 20 Naval Air Squadron. We had an AEO, who's my boss. We had a deputy and an assistant. Those two roles were really, you know, his two people out on the flight deck doing the business day by day. I had special responsibility for support, and so this fell firmly in my remit. We were very lucky, and strangely lucky, and here's a story that's not often told. It was Easter leave. The ship had come in before Easter leave. Now, 99 times out of 100, or 999 times out of 1,000, as the ship came in, we would disembark by air and fly back to our home base at Cold Rose, taking all our stores, or an amount of them. We'd then do a load of flying when we got back from leave, and a couple of weeks later we joined the ship. On this occasion, completely unusually, we'd left the aircraft on board. I've no idea why. I'm not going to guess or speculate. The reason given to us, which was perfectly logical, was the ship was sailing immediately on completion of leave. And the CO had taken a view, well, actually, if we leave the aircraft on board with four or five guys to look after it, we can leave all the stores on board, and then we can just come back and restart. And he got special approval from Flag Officer Naval Aviation to do that. It would have meant our first 2 days at sea, we would have had to fly the chaps ashore and do some shore-based, you know, get back in the saddle type stuff. But that wasn't a big problem. So in terms of moving the aircraft and the aircraft support kit, we had no problem. We didn't have to do it. As far as storing the ship went, we also had a bit of luck. We were scheduled later that year to do a major deployment to the Far East. So we'd spent most of January and February ordering every single item of stores for a 6-month deployment to the Far East. So when the Falklands switched on, just all of those went from 07 priority to 01. Now 01 was reserved for nuclear submarine, in fact not just any old nuclear submarines, but the bombers. So all that we really had to do when we got on board was cope with the tidal wave of stuff that was turning up. But we'd actually done all our work. We actually knew what we wanted. We'd also done, and this will come in later on, we'd done a major, we were the first squadron to equip with the Seeking Mark 5s. So we'd done a major servicing review in the November of the year before. So we were very confident in how much servicing we needed to do to keep the aircraft going. So we were quite unusual.
Okay.
So the difficulties were, first of all, well, we got in the squadron building at about 10 o'clock, and my wife had driven me in there, and she came in while I got myself settled down, and we were finding that our squadron recall lists were completely out of date. So we were starting to burn the phone lines with director inquiries, tracking people down by surname. And so my wife, very honourably, is a good Royal Navy wife, jumped on and manned the phones. And for the first 3 hours of the recall, she basically ran it from the squadron building. The coaches left at 1800 that night, and we trucked down to Portsmouth that Thursday night. And then we basically got the squadron together. We had one straggler from the whole squadron, and his excuse, which was a very poor one, was he was actually getting married on this Saturday. You just couldn't get the staff then.
A terrible excuse. Yeah. Terrible excuse.
Right.
So you've got aboard ship.
Yeah.
What was it? You know, knowing you were going down to fight. How did that affect what you were doing on board ship? Was there a different atmosphere? Was there more training going on? Was there a lot more first aid, I presume, and perhaps some battle damage training? And, you know.
Well, the kind of interesting thing to see, we'd been through Ost-Bost and Kost only August the year before, so we were pretty much in date for that, we thought. The other thing is, of course, it's important to us, at that point, we didn't know we were going to fight. If you think back to those very early days, well, of course, yeah, movie spec, you weren't there, but I'll tell you what it was like. It was very uncertain. There was a lot of, everybody was hoping that the Douglas Haig diplomacy shuttle would pay off. And of course, don't forget how long it was since any of the armed forces of Britain had been in a proper shooting war, apart from, of course, the poor bloody army doing their bit over in Ireland. Most of your captains wandering around the Navy at that time had no gongs. Of course, there hadn't been any gongs, because the Royal Navy only hands out gongs if you go to war. It's quite tight on that. So there was a lot of suppressed excitement, you know, that something was going to happen and we were going to be part of it, but we didn't really know what. For our part, as an anti-submarine warfare squadron, don't forget this was really Cold War. So we'd been trained to run an anti-submarine barrier. We were the first squadron equipped with sonar buoy equipped Sea Kings, but one thing very, very quickly became apparent, that against the sort of submarines we were working against, sonar buoys were out. So it was back to good old active dunking. So we expected to go down there, do an anti-submarine dunking, what's called a ripple, and we'll talk about that I think in a bit, and do a lot of load lifting. And that's pretty much it worked out. So the first thing to do really was, well, of course, you know, it's said to be apocryphal, but no, it was absolutely true. We did load tons and tons and tons of Argentinian beef, standing in big long lines, and loads of beer. Hundreds and hundreds of barrels of beer were loaded up. And other stuff began appearing, lots of weapon stores. But of course, the thing to remember about when we departed was it was controlled chaos. Only the Royal Navy, in my opinion, could have done what we did, which was our chance was to sail on the Monday. And that was a huge political statement. Massive, massive political statement. All the histories of the war have shown that it shook the Argentinians completely. You know, it all happened on the Wednesday night, and 3 working days later, a task force sails, and the determination is, we're coming down, boys. So to do that, Kit just went on whichever ship was going out at what time. So there wasn't very much, you know, it was just throwing it on the ships and sail at that point. I'll tell you a bit of the uncertainty. As we sailed out, we could hear the bands on the dockside playing. They were playing Sailing by Rod Stewart, which is a tune I hated then and I loathe now. And I and 3 of my mates were standing in the aircraft control room with the aircraft control room off. So that's the little room off the flight deck that controls all aircraft movements. And he leant over to us and he said with a fag in his mouth, "When do you think we're going to come back then?" And he pulled his China graph out. He said, "I think this date," and he wrote it on the white paint next to his desk. And I gave my date, my mate, and then my boss gave his date, which was one day out for when we actually came back. An interesting thing, and that panel of metal is now in the Fleet Air, is now in the Royal Navy Museum. It was salvaged because they put a picture frame, in fact, over it, and they salvaged it when they scrapped the ship. Interestingly, my mate thought three weeks. I thought 2 months. It was only my boss who thought we were going away for 6 months. And so that gives you an idea of the uncertainties that we had when we sailed. But a lot of excitement, a lot of thought, at last we've got a chance of doing the job we've been trained to do. It sounds very, very sort of British and stiff upper lip. Nobody was running around bashing their chest and eating raw meat, you know.
Right then. So, what did you do to work up the squadron? As you said, you've already alluded to what they knew. It was going to be a slightly different war facing the Argentinians' SSKs, conventional submarines, to facing the Soviet nuke boats. How did the squadron react to that? Because presumably that most of their training had been focusing on facing the Soviet nuke boats, which was the height of the Cold War.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, of course, the basic job of an ASW squadron is dictated by the threat. SSKs, you're basically, they can only attack you from where you're going. They can't catch you up. So the basic job that we knew was going to be to keep an ASW barrier going in front of the fleet. What I would say, and it's something you'll hear me say a few times during this, is our leadership of our squadron was just outstanding. We had an absolutely marvellous leadership. And quite a few things happened. Let me talk to the engineering first. The first thing that happened was we were given a whole load of extra people because the chaps in the staff reckoned that we needed a lot more people. And we were just given these people. My boss sent 30% of them back and said, no, I don't want these people because they're no good. And we were astonished. He said, you can't do that. We need them. He said, we've trained. We've done this. If we need more people, we'll get them. But at this point, I'd rather go with the people we want. As far as the flying went, now don't forget I was an engineer, but I did have quite a good sight of what went on. We had a load of extra crews we brought in. We had 9 aircraft. We were given 2 additional aircraft later on as we sailed south. And we normally ran with somewhere like 13 or 14 crews. We were given an extra 5 crews. The crew consisted of a P1, P2, an observer, and an air crewman. And there weren't now 19 of all of those. There were a few of them double-hatted. The thing that I vividly remember and was very, very smart was our people realised that to fight a prolonged war, the most important thing was going to be getting the right people in the right teams. So for approximately 3 weeks, our senior pilot, senior observer, and CO shuffled the crews by age, experience, personality, and shuffled the crews until they felt they had the best fit. So each day the aircraft were flying and they were shuffling the crews and our execs were watching them and seeing how they worked. It was a really, really neat piece of work. We were, the other thing was, of course, we were up to from 9 to 11 Sea Kings. We were up to a full complement of Shah's sea carriers. And of course, we were working at an increased tempo. So again, the flight deck was gradually worked up to the full tempo. Invincible's flight deck was very, very small. We had to learn how to get along. We had to realise that during the day, the Sea Harriers had the runway to themselves. And that I had 11 aircraft and I had 2 spots to work them from. And one of them wasn't very good. So I had 11 aircraft and 1 spot. And that was for takeoffs, landings, ground runs and maintenance. That's quite tricky, especially when you realise that to get the aircraft up and down from the hangar, I black the runway. So moves up and down from the hangar had to become very, very quick. But the important thing was we stuck to our rules. We didn't shortcut. We just did what we did. We just did a lot more quickly. So a hangar move that took 5 minutes now to 45, about 1 minute 10. If you've seen the film Master and Commander, where they're practicing the gun drills, you get the idea.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, at what point did the change come in that the squadron realised and you realised that it wasn't that Douglas Haig wasn't going to be successful and that this actually was going to turn into a fight?
From my point of view, I think for all of us, the turning point was Ascension. One little thing that did happen that was quite awkward was 6 hours out from Portsmouth on the day we'd sailed, there was a banging and we lost one of our couplings in the main gearboxes, which put us down to 1 shaft. This has never been discussed very openly, but I think now we're 30 years on, I can say that we had a replacement coupling flown out to us in Mounts Bay in the middle of the night by a Chinook. And in the next 2 weeks at sea, the stokers on board achieved the absolute impossible. The last time a coupling like that had been changed, it was in dry dock for 4 months. They did it at sea, in the Bay of Biscay, in fairly rough weather, in about 8-9 days. Just astonishing work. So we got down to Ascension with quite a feeling of determination. Ascension Island, when we got there, was just unbelievable. Just loads and loads of ships. The sky, I can safely say for the 8th time in my life, was black with aircraft. And it was wonderful to see because they were all naval aircraft. There were a couple of RAF yellows seeking standard, but that was it. And it was just basic rules of the airmanship, just forming an enormous queue and helicopters going in, picking stuff up, flying out to a ship, rejoin the queue, back and round. And we were just continuously storing there for a number of days. And most of the stuff coming on board was bombs, guns and bullets. Most of it was bombs, guns and bullets. And I think that was the point at which we were. And by that point, the Hague diplomacy was just about done. And yeah, that was pretty memorable, that. I don't remember seeing so many high explosive bits of stuff in my life at once. Sea skewer missiles, torpedoes, bombs, rockets, cannon shells, small arms ammunition, mines, oh, you name it. It was that was pretty memorable. We were also offloading a lot of stuff, so all our furnishings were going. All our bits of formica panels, loads of that was either being thrown over the back or going off, being offloaded. And yeah, that was pretty much the point. And I think actually the one that really got us was about Ascension Island, that we filled out all our Geneva Convention little white card, which gave your name, rank, and number. You had to carry that all the time. The idea was, you know, if you're captured, you hand that over, and that was that sort of thing. I mean, that was a pretty sobering experience. But yeah, that was pretty much it. And the night I think we sailed from Ascension Island, we had a brief on the ship's TV system from a team who'd flown down to brief us. And this was really the first we heard of things like Exocet and no AEW. And I think it's fair to say that the brief finished in the ship was pretty pensive. And about 2 seconds later, the ship's TV came on, and it was our captain, who his antennae had tweaked, and he looked us in the eye and said, well, you've heard the brief, I expect you want to know how this is going to go for us. He said, we're going to piss it. Click, and turn off. The ship went broad back up again. I should mention our captain, Captain J.J. Black, Jeremy Black. I don't think there was a man on that ship who wouldn't have eaten ground glass while jumping off a cliff for that man. Quite astonishingly gifted leader. Absolutely outstanding. And a very great stroke of luck that we got him as a captain. He joined us, I think, about the back end of 1981, early 82. A very, very old sawhorse gunnery branch officer, and just an inspiring character. Often, you know, people go on about this and people say, oh, well, you know, people always say that. No. Every single person on that ship, you talk to anybody who was on Invincible down there, say the same thing. Absolutely inspiring man. So when he said, we're going to go down and do it, I think that was the point at which there was a mental girding of loins, thought, okay, fine, yeah. Okay. Go. Yeah.
And so when you left Ascension, I suppose that was the point at which you had to start putting up the barrier.
But that was the point at which we started getting ready to Ripple. I seem to remember the Ripple start on my birthday. It was about 22nd of April. Yeah, we were, by that time, the threat levels going up. There was a possibility that the Archers, and as you may know, there were scares at Ascension that somebody had sighted a periscope, and the Argentines have since claimed that there was a submarine there. I don't know if that was true. But we were, by that time, yeah, we were rippling. We were getting ready to do that. Plus, we were flying during the day, so our flying task had begun to take shape, and we were sort of getting in a groove. Sea Harrier flying, of course, they were now flying. They now had aircraft fully at alert all the time. I mean, we experienced the first one, of course, well. I think the first one was only just south of Ascension. They sent a Boeing 707 up to have a look at us. We weren't allowed to shoot him down at that point. One thing I ought to mention, actually, was the very, very good rules of engagement. Don't forget, this was in an earlier, less difficult age. Everything came in on signals, and, you know, I would go down to the comms end two or three times a day and read my signal pack and the signal pack in the briefing room. You just chase through them, and when you got to where your divider was, you took it out, put it back on top, leave arch fire, and away you went. Very, very easy way to do. A lot quicker, incidentally, than scrolling through a screen. And we got rules of engagement briefed to us as we went down, and an abiding memory is how good they were. They were extremely clear, and the other abiding memory is how quickly they were being developed and tuned. So it was very, very clear the point at which we could go out and look at an Argentine 707, and the point at which if he came anywhere near us, he was going home in the life raft. So there was very, very good communication of rules of engagement now to everybody on the everybody in the fleet. That was extremely good.
Okay. And explain the ripple to me.
Great, yeah. Okay. Well, the objective is to keep a number of aircraft active dunking in a couple of sectors, normally in front of the fleet. To explain what dunking is, the aircraft comes down into a hover about 40 feet above the sea. It was held there on the Sea King by a very complicated and very early type of flight control system. It would then drop out of the inside of the aircraft. It would drop a sonar body in on a piece of electric string a certain amount of feet long, which I'm not at liberty to divulge, and that would then start to ping and listen. The crew would ping for a certain amount. It would then up, jump to somewhere else in its sector, ping and go, ping and go. What the ripple was let's say you were running a two aircraft sector, which was normal, two sectors, you'd launch two cabs, they'd go out there and start pinging in their sectors. A couple of hours later, you'd launch a third aircraft go out, he would relieve one of the aircraft out there, and the other aircraft would come back. Shortly after that, you'd launch another aircraft, and that would relieve the second aircraft. And that was called a Ripple 3. Two aircraft on task, one either going out there, coming back, or refueling and rearming on deck. So three aircraft serviceable all the time, 24 hours a day. Now, so that's the Ripple. There were a number of challenges associated, but that's what it was.
And what was the serviceability of the squadron at this point? Because I presume after the extremists of war operations, various it sort of went down, but at this point it must have been sort of their peak.
Well, we'd been doing a lot of work tuning the aircraft up. One of the weak points, there were a couple of known weak points on the aircraft. The sonar system was a pretty ancient 1960s kit. It was very, very, very first generation transistor piece of kit, but pretty ancient. And that just needed a lot of work. So we came up with my boss came up with an idea, what we called the flying pinkies. I'll just say before I lapse into too much jargon, some of the traits. The mechanical trait in the fleet now are called the grubbers. The electrical trade are called greenies. The radio trade, who looked after sonar, were called pinkies. And the trade who look after the air weapons are bombets. The pinkies, what we came up with an idea was, when the aircraft first launched on its first, because I'll talk in a minute about how the aircraft rotated through, but when the aircraft went off on its first sortie, we would stick a pinky in the back and he would tweak the sonar on the first dip to make sure it was absolutely on. Because one of the things we found was if you did that, it seemed to give us a better longevity of the sonar. The other thing we knew was the air crewmen were not entirely innocent. Sometimes they'd take a totally illegal screwdriver up with them and have a go at adjusting the sonar themselves, which was really a good idea. So we sent these fine pinkies up. So that gave us better serviceability. The other thing that we did was we very quickly realized that the best way to keep aircraft serviceable was to keep them running all the time. So we did everything we could to not take the aircraft out of the fly pro. I'll just explain, the fly pro is the flying program. So your ripple three lines will be three lines of effort going along now. And the cabs would go out for about 4 hours. They'd come back for about 20 or 25 minutes, depending on the time for a turnaround it was, and then launch again. Of course, if they were coming back unserviceable, you would have to slot a new aircraft in, so you were slotting aircraft in and out of these lines. One of the things we had only just got a few months before in the Navy was a new system called continuous charge. Let me explain how most air forces work. The aircraft, the pilot goes and signs the aircraft out. He takes it flying. When he comes back, he signs the aircraft all the way back in, writes down all the snags, and the aircraft is then serviced, and when it's ready, it's handed over to the next pilot. On a flight deck, that's never going to work. So we had a system where it was called continuous charge, where the aircraft stayed on the charge of the pilots, and we had a special sheet where the pilots handed it over to each other, not to us. However, we'd worked out that if we could change boxes during that period of handover on the flight deck, that might be a good idea. And our squadron, my squadron AEO, came up with a set of rules for this, which we did, and it absolutely saved our bacon, and it was pushed out very quickly to the remainder of the fleet. So one of the worst boxes on the aircraft was the main UHF radio. It's called the ARC-52, and it was a 1940s piece of kit. It was horribly unreliable. But we were able, using this routine, the aircraft would come down, so the rotors are still going round, the crew are changing, we're perhaps loading torpedoes. We were able to pop the nose bay door open, whip the radio out, put a new one in, functionally check it, and go. So by dint of doing that, my 820 achieved an average serviceability of 85%.
That's high.
That's well, we did a few other things as well. We broke every single record, world record, for number of days continuous flying, number of hours flown in a week, number of hours flown in a month, number of aircraft sorties flown. Our squadron just absolutely flew the bejesus out of the aircraft. And the aircraft responded extremely well. And it was an abiding memory, an abiding lesson, which I and a lot of other aircraft engineers learned, that the best way to operate aircraft is to fly them hard. Now, of course, airlines are very, very familiar with this, but it was quite an exhilarating achievement. And the credit goes to my AEO, who was just, again, an inspiring leader.
And, of course, 820 Squadron does have a history of doing this, having done that quite something quite similar in the Second World War. Right then. So, God, that sounds bad. It sounds like I'm actually, for the first time, I'm reading one of my questions. The rest have been off the cuff.
That's all right. It's cool.
Right. So, with that serviceability, with that sort of the ripple going on, could you, for contrast, explain what the other sort of you talked earlier about the sonar boys versus pinging. Would that operation have changed if you'd been using the sonar boys more and facing a nuclear threat, or would you have still kept up with that sort of similar methodology?
The sonar boy stuff was a bit different. You were laying sonar boys at various places. It was often on the flanks. You might be trying to go further out. So these, the active sonar pinging was normally reasonably close in. It was different, but the essentials on the flight deck were not much different. The main difference would have been the need to replenish the sonar boys all the time, and we did have quite a few on board, although we didn't use any. But the main thing was really fuel and weapons. I ought to explain, by the way, I explained the Ripple 3, which is a pretty good feat. I should explain that during the day, we would be required to do at least another four lines flying on top of that three from about 08 through to about 1730. Basically sunrise to sunset. And that would be lifting and shifting people, stuff, things, things. So that's why we broke all the records for the amount of flying. We were flying on average, we had serviceability of, in fact, 81%. We were putting up on average 7 or 8 aircraft per day out of 11. And we had a spare on deck, by the way, as well. So pretty busy. But yeah, in terms of the basic job, much the same, whether we've been doing it that way or doing it in the dunk.
So I take it the spare was stuck in the more difficult spot.
No, the spare was stuck in the easiest spot possible to get out onto my spot, which was number 5 spot, which was immediately after the island down on the starboard side. So we put the what was called the sod, the spare on deck, was stuffed immediately alongside the aft side of the island on the port side. The only slight problem with that was it was immediately next to the lift. So we couldn't quite tie it down. And the other thing was, if at night you were going past the spare on deck, you had to make sure where the lift was. Otherwise you could take a rather quick trip down to the shed. But no, it was in the easiest place you possibly, because if you needed the spare, you needed it there and then. We didn't want to do a hangar move to screw up the Sea Harriers alert. So the spare on deck was always ready to go. And, it was always in a very advanced state of preparedness.
Okay. So, what was 820's experience, anti-submarine-wise, before we get on to everything else, of the Falklands?
I'll do it from our view and from what we know. There's not much about it from the Argentine point of view. Anti-submarine warfare is a bit like sprinkling, in fact, elephant powder in a room. You know, you sprinkle the elephant powder in a room, people say, oh, I can't see any... elephants, you say, oh, that's because we sprung all the, in fact, elephant powder. You spend a lot of time trying to, you know, hoping there's not a submarine there, hoping you're deterring them. We had a number of sonar contacts, which we prosecuted. Almost all of those turned out to be fairly large examples of marine life. I have to report to you that if a sperm whale encounters a Mark 46 torpedo, it's not the Mark 46 torpedo that comes off worst. We also depth charged a school of dolphins one day, which didn't look too good. I think if Greenpeace had been filming, they wouldn't have liked what we had to do. The trouble with whales is if you ping a whale, and this is one of the air crewmen told me this, what they do is they stop, then they turn around, run away, and then they dive as quick as they could. Well, guess what they teach submarines to do when they're pinged? Exactly the same. So there was a bit of misidentification. The Argentines claim they tried to carry out a couple of attacks on us and were deterred by the very aggressive, and these are exactly Argentine words, the very aggressive tactics of the Sea Kings. And I have to say, the driver in a Sea King crew is really the observer. The P1 and P2 at the front and the rear, they're just to drive it round. The observer is the person driving the war. And let me tell you, our observers had a set of special T-shirts made up, and their T-shirts simply said hack, maim, kill. And they were fairly wary types. And the senior observer we had, again, another excellent. Yeah, I know this is going to sound like every time I mention one of the people in charge of me, I'm saying they were excellent and fantastic. And your listeners may think, oh, yeah, well, of course he's saying that. Well, I'm saying it because we were unusually blessed with an extremely good cadre of executives, and the SOBs on our squadron simply drove those observers extremely hard. Very difficult for the observers. Their pre-mission prep was longer than for the pilots, and their post-mission debrief was longer. So the observers got less time in their racks. So it was a very hard war for those guys. Very tough. And so they were very aggressive, and, you know, they were trained that in, you know, there's the least chance of something being out there, you just started hunting it big time, and they would call the others seeking, and they really tried to prosecute it. But a long and difficult, and, you know, especially, you know, I think the other thing I put over to the listeners, which is one of the touchstones of the Royal Navy, is when you see a Sea King doing his dunking on a bright sunlit day, you know, on a flat sea, yeah, okay, it looks, you know, people think, oh, well, that's okay. Let me assure you that when you're sending those people out, you know, which I had to do on the flight deck, I didn't fly, when it's, you know, very, very big seas, I mean, we're talking waves over 55 feet high. Well, the aircraft hovers at 40 feet. So as each wave comes in, the aircraft rides up and over the wave and down into the trough of the next one. It's very dark most of the time there. We were there in the middle of winter. And the weather was frequently just abominable. Now, that's when a fighting component earns its pay. It's easy to do on a bright day. It's doing it in the middle of the small hours when it's absolutely honking it, and your aircraft coming back covered in films of ice. You have to chip the ice off when you send them downstairs. I mean, that's a bit more exciting. And that was quite hard work.
And you've talked about the spare aircraft, you've talked about the trolls. How often do you have to use the spare aircraft during the conflict?
Oh, Lord, all the time. Well, what we tried to do was, let me give a little bit more detail without boring the pants off the listeners. The aircraft in those days, we could fly them for about 25 hours before they had to come down into the shed. And the main reason for that was we had a servicing operation we had to do, which had come up. We actually fought this war with a problem in the tail rotor bearings, and every 25 hours we had to do a check on it. Most of our servicing ops were arranged in blocks of 25, 50, 100 hours. The way we operate aircraft in the Navy, again, as opposed from an Air Force, is different for a very good reason. Not good or bad or better, just different. And the RN operate something called flexible servicing. What does that mean? Let's take an RAF aircraft. They'll have loads of servicing operations which have periodicities of 25, 50 hours. They'll do them in blocks. They'll do it. They'll clear the aircraft for 25 hours or 50 hours. They'll then put the aircraft up, and at the end of 50 hours, it comes out. And if the aircraft has 6 hours or 3 hours to go, they'll put it on the line, fly the 3 hours out, bring it back in. On a naval experience where you've got that very crowded flight deck, you've got to get every bit of flying out of the aircraft. We have this flexible system where we controlled all of those servicing ops individually. I had the latitude to extend them a bit or pull them back. So if we had an aircraft that had, say, 6 hours left, but we knew by doing a few servicing ops we could get it up to 14 hours, and that would get us through the next bit of the fly probe, we'd do that. So aircraft were pulled either on a planned basis. If they were planned, we wouldn't use the spare on deck. We'd bring a new aircraft up, and we'd do what we called the squirt past the spare. I mean, there was a lot of arcane wording that we tend to put up. But essentially what it meant was, in a planned way, I'd bring another aircraft up from the shed. I'd have it ready on another spot. When that aircraft came in, I would shut it down and get it struck down in the hangar. I'd then launch the new aircraft into the ripple from that spot. And that's how we would do that. If the aircraft went unserviceable during, you know, if it was coming back unserviceable, then again, we'd try and bring a replacement aircraft up. And we would only use the spare on deck if the aircraft went unserviceable on start. And then we'd throw the spare on deck in. Just a little piece that your listeners may find of interest. People think when you go to war, oh, well, you know, you're going to stop all the servicing and you just fight the aircraft and, you know, pick up the pieces afterwards. We were, I seem to remember, on the way down to Ascension, and we got a signal in. I was on the 700 desk. Sorry, let me explain that. In the aircraft control room, there's aircraft control room, in fact, also with his Ouija board doing all these things. And crammed in there are two desks, one for each of the squadrons, one for the Sea Harrier squadron, one for us. And that's where the pilots sign their aircraft in and sign them out. That's where I had my desk. Actually, I had an occasional chair, which I shared a desk with a PO. That's where I'd work all the books. And a signal came in from flag officer Carra's amphibious ship saying we could now go to wartime servicing, and instructing us we could extend all our servicing operations out by very big latitudes, and we could write them off as ASOPs as soon as operationally practical. So I got my red pen out. I was very excited by this. I was hammering through the books, scrubbing out all the spin, putting all these, you know, so our aircraft would hardly need any servicing at all. And my PO tapped me on the shoulder and said, sir, I think it was a look round, and behind me was stood my AEO. And he asked a question that I should have asked myself 2 hours before. He said, Steve, who do you work for? I said, well, I work for you, sir. He said, what are you doing there? I said, well, I've had this signal in, sir, and I'm adjusting all the servicing. And he repeated his question. Who do you work for? I said, I work for you, sir. He said, did I tell you to do that? I said, no, sir, but I've got this signal here from the flag. He said, no, Steve, you work for me, so come down to my cabin and bring the assistant and the senior maintenance rating. And he announced to us that we were staying on peacetime servicing. And there was a sort of a silent pause in the cabin. Who's going to be the first to say to the AEO, you're off your head? I want to explain that my AEO was an extremely forceful character, very ferociously intelligent, and not known for taking too many prisoners. But he then leant forward and explained, and he said, we're going to be here for 6 months. We're sending those crews out into the most god-awful conditions. These aircraft are going to be in the best of condition. You remember a few minutes ago I said that we'd done a servicing review. Mm-hmm. He said, do we believe in what we said then? He said, yes. He said, right, well, that's what we'll do then. And the only thing we stopped doing was routine husbandry surveys, which we used to call rust and dust. We caught those up. This was a quite exceptionally brilliant move for two reasons. Firstly, it assured us that the aircraft would maintain the high serviceability, as I'll explain to you. That's exactly what they did. Mm-hmm. The second thing was an absolute stroke of brilliance. On the few occasions when we could stand down, and I think I want to explain, our workforce was divided into two watches, port and starboard watch. We had approximately, it was about 45, 47 people per watch. The watch chief would never have, let me explain our watch routine. It was 8 hours on, 8 hours off. So you would turn to, let's say you come on at midnight, you work through to 08, you turn in at 0800, you'd sleep until 4 o'clock, that's afternoon, you get up, you then work through to midnight, you go to sleep, you get up at 8, you'd work through to 4, right? Very punishing routine. And don't forget, most of our people were working either on the out on the flight deck in pretty arctic conditions, or down in the hangar where every time the lift came down, about 400 gallons of water came off the flight deck. Not particularly nice. So our watch chiefs were conserving our people. So they would not bring everybody out of their racks. They'd do what we call selective shakes. They'd only shake the people we needed to keep the fly pro going. What my boss's decision meant was when we were able to stand down, we could just stop work and send all the lads off to their racks to get some sleep. Squadrons that didn't do that were faced with the fact that as soon as they stopped flying, they then had a huge pile of maintenance to do. So this was an inspired call, and a very brave one too. So that's what we did, and it made a huge difference to us. And that whole business of conserving sleep, explain 8 hours on, 8 hours off, works out as a 96-hour week. But you could only really do that for about 12 days full on, until bits started to drop off your brain. And my boss would then step in and give me some time off, step in and give my winger some time off. It's quite hard work. I lost a stone and a half.
That's a lot.
Yeah, well, I wasn't a particularly fat guy either.
Yeah, so I've met you a few times. You've never struck me as a rotund gentleman in any stretch of the imagination.
No, I was quite thin when I came out.
Yeah.
As was just about everybody.
So, you've got all these... What were there any specific engineering challenges which occurred because of the South Atlantic environment? As you've been over, it was quite brutal. Did that reveal anything? Was there anything that had worked fine and looked okay in North Atlantic, but then in the extreme situation of the South Atlantic, it was...
Once again, this is going to sound incredibly complacent. I'm trying not to, because I know what your listeners would like. So, oh, yes, it was all incredibly unbelievable, and, yeah, and we had to struggle, but by God, we got through there. I think the thing I want to put over is the Royal Navy actively goes and looks for bad weather to train in. Mm-hmm. It does the JMC. You're probably familiar with that. Each year we did a joint maritime course off the north coast of Scotland. And indeed, earlier that year, we'd spent all of January and most of February getting our arses handed to us off the northern coast. There were a couple of occasions the weather down there can be quiet. On one particular night, I came up, I think I turned to about 8, and my predecessor, an absolutely lovely, lovely man, another brilliant engineer called Dougie Craig, announced that during his previous 8 hours, they changed almost every rotor blade on the aircraft because we'd hit these enormous hail and rainstorms. And the blades in that time, we were flying with the old tin blades, the old aluminium blades, and they had like a rubber strip glued on the leading edge. And the rain had just stripped it off in great horrid lumps. And as fast as we'd throw an aircraft at the problem, the rain had just stripped the blades off. And when I got up into the shed, it was just a scene of absolute chaos with blades everywhere. And what we had to do was get the blades off, dry them off as best we could, and then stick new rubber on them. And they were stuck on with some very aggressive solvents and glues that these days I'm sure would contravene every single health and safety rule we can think of, and a few more beside. The other thing I remember was there was at least an inch of water in the hangar. As we were bringing the aircraft down, this rain was simply coming down through the hangar wells, just like a waterfall. I've never seen anything quite like it. And indeed, it was one time in my life that there was they got some special flooding parties up to get the water into the lift wells and then down and then pump it out, because we were a little bit concerned about the amount of water the ship was had on. But you know, due to some magnificent efforts by our team, including one chap I have to mention, getting the blades off the back of a Sea King when it's folded. You had the top three, which were handled by we had a crane. We had like an overhead crane, and we had various JCB cranes we could use, and they weren't too bad. However, there was a blade down each side, and they were an absolute swine, because you couldn't put the lifting rig on them. And really what you were supposed to do was spread the plane and then take all five off, or we just couldn't do that. We had a petty officer on the squadron who was simply built like the original brick outhouse. And he had the talent of being able to shin up the side of a Sea King. And whilst the people, the numbers 3 and 4 blades, they would disconnect it from the head. He would then tuck the blade root under his arm and then climb down the side of the Sea King with one end of the blade in his arm. I mean, we're talking a cool couple of 100 pounds. And he saved our bacon that night, because he just flogged himself away bringing his blades up and down.
Please tell me he earned himself a mention in dispatches.
Oh, good God, no. No, 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 no. No, of course not. You got a South Atlantic gong like the remainder of us did, but that was quite some night. We had I think the main thing that everybody remembers climatically about the Falklands was the incredible rapidity with which conditions would change, and the amount of conditions you could have in a day. In one day you could have bright sunshine, howling wind, thick snow, hail, and then bright sunshine again. It was very changeable very quickly.
I think one of the Royal Marines I've interviewed for this podcast series described it as the only place ever been which could not only have 4 seasons, but 12 seasons in a day, and that was if it was slow.
Yeah, yeah, it could be very difficult. Quite challenging for the Metmen, yeah.
Right then. I'm not going to ask how successful the squadron was with submarines, because as you said, it is mostly about deterrence, so
yeah.
Mostly they don't know how successful they're being because the submarines are running away. But I'm not sure. I cannot remember for the life of me whether it was 820 which lost some aircraft to go and support the Marines, was it? No, it wasn't.
It was one of the Seeking 4 squadrons lost 22 SAS. We did actually send 2 aircraft in ashore before the end of the war. Mm-hmm. And I was actually sent ashore with them. And we operated out of the FOB at San Carlos. That was quite interesting. We had no electronic support gear, so we were issued with handheld warning receivers, which was like a handheld EW receiver you plugged into your hat. We flogged around. We were sent in there to do night missions, because none of the aircraft there had any radars that were working. However, being the exigencies of the war and the fact the Atlantic conveyor had gone down, I went in there with 2 aircraft and a total of 10 maintainers, and we ended up flying day and night, 24 hours a day for 8 days. That was quite challenging.
That was that taking on the jungly work, basically?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, yeah. We were just anything we could do, we were lifting. The basic routine was we were flying legs out, carrying gear, and if we saw any soldiers walking along the ground, we just flogged down, picked them up, and took them on. Okay. And it was in that way that one of our observers managed to take the surrender of a company of Argentines, which was all these chaps in green, went down to give them a lift, then it turned out to be fully armed Argentines who probably surrendered to a Royal Navy observer clutching a 9mm pistol on a Royal Navy air crewman with a Sterling. And he captured 10 of them, which was great. We also did, by the way, take the general in to take the surrender on the night, but you can ask me about that later on if you like.
I want to get more about this story about this observer getting these 10 Argentinians prisoner. What did they do with them? Did they fly them back in a helicopter, and did they leave their weapons behind?
Yes, they did. They all threw them on the ground, and it was great because the chaps were after war trophies at that point. So yeah, of course they were going to have a go at that. But yeah, we bought them back, and they were flogged off to one of the ships in San Carlos. Captain Irons. We also mounted the attack on the Narwhal, by the way. Mm-hmm. We did that with the SBS. 801 Squadron attacked her and strafed her, tried to bomb her and slung a bomb through her, which failed to go off, thank God. And we went and captured them. Of course, one of the ones we captured was that rather unlovely character from South Georgia. And we had to let him go, which is a bit of a shame, but we only had one guard on the ship who could speak Spanish at that point. But they were in a fairly bad way. They were civilian fishermen. The Narwhal was just a trawler, and she'd just been commandeered in a rather brutal fashion by the Argentine Navy. And indeed, I vividly remember the Argentine trawlman coming on board and being rather cut up. And so I have to say, the Royal Navy Jack, being Royal Navy Jack, instantly took pity on these things and rushed them down and plied them huge amounts of beer until they felt slightly better. But generally, there was a lot of compassion shown. We did have one particular incident that was resolved very well. Was one of our aircraft got shot down over Port Stanley, I came on watch at midnight. I remember it very clearly. Again, Doug had done all the hard work. Basically, our squad at that time had 3 aircraft in the Ripple. Within about 45 minutes, we had all 9 aircraft in the air. 45 minutes, we'd gone from 3 to 9. And the entire squadron was out trying to find Flight Lieutenant Mortimer. And he was found eventually, the flag, Hermes, after a couple of hours. I always remember I came on and I was fortunate enough to launch the last 3 aircraft into the air. Doug had done all the hard work, got them all ready. And we had all 9 aircraft in the air, and I remember there was like a big electronic button push type thing, and I remember the aircraft control room also making this enormous play about pressing the last 9th button, which was all of our aircraft in the air. And we had an instant call from the captain that instant saying, well done, you know, give my regards to the crew now. And after a couple of hours in the air, the flag on Hermes, I've been told, demanded the aircraft return to ship because they weren't going to find him. And what I can tell you is that that squadron has suffered the largest simultaneous radio failure in the history of naval aviation. Gave the flag a good ignoring. And then one of our observers consulted his tide tables, and he worked out where he thought the pilot might be. So he and the senior pilot pushed off there, and they found him, and they brought him back on board. And I had the great honour to be on duty in the aircraft control room when Badgley and Mortimer was brought back on board. And that was a real moment for the ship and the air group and the crews. It was really quite good.
It is amazing how often the Royal Navy, though, can have radio troubles. It really does plague the naval service.
I see no ships.
Yes, the lack of no signals, you know, it has such a history, you know, that problem was Nelson had at Copenhagen, famously.
Well, absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
And, so you know, there have been so many more. Yeah.
But once again, though, the thing I would point out is it was a very, by that time, the squadron was an enormously high, in fact, operational pitch of competence, confidence, and ability. And it was only that that allowed us to do that. It wasn't a press-on, gung-ho spirit. It was a very, very determined, professional bit of airmanship. And that's something that people... One of things were, we were basically still flying mostly to peacetime rules. And our... And, you know, we had certain exceedances we were allowed to do, but in general terms, our execs were absolutely hard over that we were not going to lose anybody down there to being stupid and pressing on. And indeed, a number of pilots who did press the stupid button were very quickly brought up and taken out of the fly prow and stuck down the hole. They were stuck down in the lower air ops for a few days. We were absolutely determined to bring all our people back, and that's what we did. But you don't do that by just hoping for it. You got to work for it.
And, of course, being on the ship you were on, HMS Invincible, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Which, of course, the Argentinians, I think, claimed to sink twice, was it? Yes, or three times?
Yeah.
What was it? I know you've already discussed, you know, the briefing and the feeling of that. But did that at all, were you at all thinking about that when you're at sea? I'm sitting on what is the biggest target out here and they're gunning for me. Or was it more a case of, let's show them what we can do?
That's a really, really good question, actually, because it goes to a lot of the psychology of war. There were times I think the worst I felt, we were woefully unprepared in some areas. And one of them was close in weapons defense. We had nothing. So on the way down south, the amount of welding and cutting that went on was amazing. And one of the things that appeared were a number of metal posts around the flight deck down on the catwalks. And I had the great honor to be, when I was on duty, in charge of number 5 spot resistance nest, which was nothing more than a pile of sandbags and a GPMG. And a tin hat, and we would practice this a few times. And I have to say, I thought to myself, this is not the best position I really wanted to be in. We had a couple of occasions where, as the Etendard rage developed, we felt we were being attacked. And that was quite difficult. It's quite difficult. I was actually off watch when the first one happened, and you know, I sort of threw myself out of my bed. It's amazing how quickly, I mean, we weren't supposed to get undressed. We were supposed to stay in our action gear 24 hours. But frankly, when I could get in my rack, I wanted a proper sleep. And to this day, my wife often remarks that I can get dressed in about 15 seconds flat if I want to. It's quite hard to lie on the deck of your cabin waiting, knowing if it is going to happen, the ship's going to go black and you're going to be, and you're suddenly trying to remember which way is it to that ladder, is it up there, you know, you're trying to remember all your things. That's quite hard. But it's not being too jingoistic. The ability of the Navy, of a crew like that, I think, well, let me tell you, after the first Etendard raid, Jack got busy with his paintbrush, and we found that when you went into the hangar via the hangar airlocks, you were no longer entering the hangar. You were entering the Exocet receiving room, which they painted up. So the black humour helped. There was a very strong determination. I think going into the TEZ on the 1st of May, the total exclusion zone, when it really got properly on, again, I look back with a bit of distance and I look at what our captain was doing. It was very early in the morning. I seem to remember it was about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, so it was pitch black. It was a lot of fog around. And I was on deck. I was just seeing an aircraft off. And quite suddenly, the tannoy came up and the captain came up and said to the crew, right, they called action stations very early on, so the whole ship was up. And the captain came up and said, right, we're entering the total exclusion zone. You know, we're now under full rules of engagement. You know, you all know what that means. And then he just, in a very clipped voice, said, hoist the battle ensigns. The battle ensign of the first HMS Invincible, which you may remember was sunk at Jutland, was in the wardroom at Collingwood. Only it wasn't. He'd got it, and he hoisted the battle ensign of the World War One Invincible at the mainmast, along with two more battle ensigns on the foremast. And I just vividly remember seeing those go up and cracking out. It was a very strong wind, about 30 knots of wind. And I think at that moment, I could have eaten an Argentinian if he'd landed on the flight deck. Well, I think the whole crew did. You know, the whole crew were just, it was just the most amazingly stirring feeling. But again, that was our captain just working that bit of magic to give us the confidence. I think as well as that, I want to stress, it wasn't incredibly individually heroic, certainly not on my part. I was plenty scared most of the time. I think there's been a spate of very good books written, not about the Falklands per se, but about the Navy, and one of them is called The Habit of Victory. And it's an American book, I think. And I think, I know this is going to sound, anybody who listens to this, they're probably going to want to turn off or throw up. You do get a bit of that, well, who are you? We're the Royal Navy. We go and we win. You know, and the old Joy Jack Tar stuff, we'll fight and we'll win again. Yeah, well, that's what we were expected to do. So there was a sort of a, not very jingoistic, but very calm determination that we were going to do it. And that was quite a feeling.
Well, I have to say, I often ask my students the question, which is the only democracy which has ever hung senior officers for failing to engage the enemy?
Yeah.
The only one is Britain, and it was an admiral.
The Navy's pretty tough that way, but I think the important thing for your listeners to know is that spirit and all that, which is all okay, is the final garnish on top of utter professionalism, which is what I was fortunate enough to be trained to. And that comes about training, and it's training, leadership, and more training, and then you're ready, and then you can do the yo-ho bit. But until you've done the training, you don't do the yo-ho bit. That's the right way around. And I'll say we were lucky. We were very lucky. Well, we were fortunate. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, going on from this sort of, what was it, when you transferred ashore, you've already discussed some of the difficulties you had, but what was it, what did you take with you? What was the thing said, right now, we need to take this with us if we're going ashore?
That's brilliant, that's such a good question. It's a little vignette list, I think for any young engineers listening out there, I'd like to be inspired by this. I was, I'd gone off, I think I'd gone off watch at about 8 p.m. and I was in Iraq, and at 11:30 or so, the door of my cabin flung itself open, the light came on, and my boss was stood there and said, Steve, get up. You're taking two aircraft inshore to San Carlos with the senior pilot. Select your crew, you can have 10, and you can take whatever stores you can fit in the back of two Sea Kings plus you. And the door shut. So I made my way down to the hangar, selected my 10, and basically got my senior chief and said, what do you think we ought to take, Chief? I had a few ideas, but basically we took a few of the known common use items, but we couldn't take anything big. We couldn't take a spare engine or gearbox, and we couldn't take anything big. So we could take a few of those terrible radios, we took a couple of those, although we knew we were working with a seeking outfit ashore, so we could share some of their stores with them. Took a lot of the documentation stuff that you have to run, just, you know, so you have to keep, even in the middle of a war, the paperwork keeps going. As far as personal kit goes, this was quite interesting because none of us had been issued with any combat kit, and we were a bit short. So we rushed down to stores, the stores opened up, and we were issued with combat gear. I had putties, I had a string vest which was actually dated 1916, and it was actual string vest. It was a bit of string. It was a World War One string vest. One of our biggest problems was accommodation. All the tents had gone down on Atlantic Conveyor, so we raided the ship's ex-bed stores. We got a number of pup tents. There were 10 maintainers, me, and there were about 8 or 9 aircrew, about 12 aircrew, so we roused as many pup tents as we could, threw them all in the back, and off we went. Threw ourselves in the back of the Sea King. So I think we launched at about 5 o'clock in the morning and flew all the way in at about 20 foot above the sea. Quite terrifying. I was wedged in the back. Even if we'd gone in, I could never have got out of the aircraft because I couldn't move. There's so much stuff on and around me, you couldn't move. And we landed in at first light.
You know, pup tents, etc. From what you said about your room, I presume you hadn't actually had experience in the Commando Helicopter Force. So what was it like to be suddenly thrust into what is their job, living in the field?
Well, yeah. I mean, we had no idea. Fortunately, we were sharing the field with 825 Squadron, who were actually 706 Squadron, who'd been rebadged. They were what they called Pingleys. We were called a Pinger. A jungly was a jungly. Well, we were Pingleys. And we sort of made the best of it that we could, really. As I said, I was expecting, we were briefed. We were only going to fly at night. So we landed just before dawn. I remember we landed, it was pitch dark, and we were shown to just a patch of grass. I didn't know what the hell was going on. And we were told, well, we'll shut the aircraft down, and then we'll wait for orders, because most of the flying ashore happened at first light. Well, when the first light came up, my senior pilot, well, he strode off to the ops tent there and strode back and said, Steve, bit of a change of plan. We're flying. And I said, when so? He said, now. So got my team back out to the aircraft, got them started up. Got, you know, I said, when will you be back? We'll be back when we're back. We'll let you know. Right, okay. So they clattered off. And at that point, we started thinking about, okay, well, so we spoke to the basic guys and they said, well, you know, you can pitch your pup tents. And they looked at our pup tents and laughed because they were all in big cold weather tents. They said, well, you can pitch them over there. Where do we eat? They said, well, there's a field kitchen over there. Because we bought hexamine stoves. We thought we might have to do all ourselves in there, and we didn't. There was actually a kitchen was up. There was a set of latrines and that sort of thing. So that was all dug. There were trenches. That was quite interesting. Loads of trenches. We had to dig a couple of trenches. We were actually under threat of air attack a few times. And then as the light grew on, people from 825 come to us and said, hey, have you guys got any of these? Have you got any stores? Well, yeah, we have. So most of our stores were gone in the first 30 minutes trying to keep 825 in here. So they were flying really hard. They were doing some really tough stuff. So we just clocked on from there. The things were going swimmingly, really. That's how it went. We had some quite interesting adventures with that little team ashore, which I won't bore you with them, you know, unless you ask. But yeah, that was basically
adventures.
Well, the things that were kind of stick in my mind was, first of all, we took the general in to take the surrender. On the night that it all became apparent, it was a typically a very foul night. It was blowing very, very strong. It was up 30 gusting, 45 knots, heavy rain, dark. And we had to get the general in. And we were the only aircraft ashore with a functioning radar and indeed a crew who could do it. So we sent an aircraft down to Fox Bay. The aircraft picked Major General Moore. Or Julian Thompson. I forget which one. Major General Moore, I think. And they, of course, by this time, no formal ceasefire had been announced. It was just a general understanding that they kind of stopped. And we flew all the way round the aircraft, I was told later. Basically, radar guided itself round to Port Stanley, did a self-controlled approach onto the end of Port Stanley radar, but didn't touch down. Switched its floodlights on, then they got their street map out of Port Stanley and hover taxied, turning right, turning left, to a government house where they sat down. And our senior pilot witnessed the surrender. in the room, which is quite fun.
A strange experience, hover taxing through Stanley.
Yeah, especially with loads of Argentines lying around in the streets all pointing guns at you. So I'm told by the crew. The following day, I was actually sent in with the senior pilot into Port Stanley with instructions to make as many aircraft as we could find as serviceable as we could. My senior pilot had flown UH-1 Hueys in an exchange post with the German army. And so I was sent in and told to make these aircraft safe and get them ready for flight, which by that time, of course, the cream of the British Army had been at them, tearing bits off them and raiding them for souvenirs. So we stopped them doing that and got them fixed as quick as we could. We got about three of them in the air.
And what was
one
that?
Of them? Yeah.
What was that for?
The idea was we were going to use them to fly people and stores around. My senior pilot was going to teach a few seeking pilots how to fly these planes, which are pretty straightforward. And we were going to use them. In the end, we got two of them to San Carlos. We ferried two. One of them is the one in the Fleet Air Museum.
Oh.
So an aircraft. And it was actually as the Argentine morale had collapsed, it started collapsing pretty early on, a peculiarly obnoxious Latin trait of departing armies is to defecate everywhere. And they had defecated in the aircraft everywhere, which was quite interesting, so I had to clean that out. They'd also rigged them up with anti-personnel mines wired up to the control rounds, which we were fortunate. Well, I was helped to find that by a Gurkha. So we had to take all those out.
Very useful gentlemen, those particular soldiers.
Those Gurkhas, you've got to love those Gurkhas.
Yes, they have a very interesting approach to warfare, I find.
They're absolutely outstanding. Yeah. They really are. But yeah, they were certainly all over the place. But yeah, so that was quite busy and quite difficult. I think to drop the war stories, I mean, really, the Argentines had surrendered, but they hadn't actually formally ceased hostilities. So, of course, the Sea Harriers were still keeping the cap. We were still pinging and doing that. Really and truly, what the squadron then very quickly did, and only a few days afterwards, I was airlifted back on board, and the squadron by that time was working into a massive load-lifting effort to get stores ashore, bring stores back, move people around, do all sorts of stuff. The RAF on Hermes were desperate to get ashore, quite rightly so. They were very well equipped to do that, so it was a big effort to get to airlift them ashore, which we did. And then we started doing a lot of work around about on the Falklands, sort of trying to help move people around. We flew into clearings, and because there were whole groups of people who were hemmed in by unknown fields of anti-personnel mines. The Argentines had dropped simply hundreds of thousands of the sods. The one that nearly got me, I was at Port Stanley and there was the shattered wreck of a sky van, and I thought, ah, that fin there is just the thing for our squadron board. So I was beetling off towards this sky van with a pair of tin snips with a determined air, and the Gurkha grabbed hold of me and said stop in a very commanding voice and looked down and scattered over the ground but what I can best describe as brown Hessian tea bags. And they were designed to blow one half of your foot off. And there were simply hundreds of thousands of those that had been scattered from the air. And so a lot of the Falklanders were stuck in the settlements and couldn't get out. So we had to fly in and bring them out and bring them into Stanley for medical treatment and that sort of thing. So it was quite hard work. Plus we were just helping to clear up the rubble of war, which was extensive.
And I suppose the squadron trying to get ashore for the RAF would have been a GR3 Harrier squadron, wouldn't it?
They were the GR3s, that's exactly right. Sorry, I should have mentioned that. Yes, yeah, they were very, very, they were an extremely good bunch. They were a very good bunch indeed.
Poor guys were real. I'm trying to persuade some to take part in the podcast. And I know they did a very good job, but some of them were really not expecting to have to do a lot prolonged exposure in sea time, and I hear there were a few cases of seasickness amongst them.
Well, I will tell you that I was seasick every time I went to sea. One of my watch chiefs, who was a simply, I'm sorry, I know it sounds like, he was a simply outstanding individual. And what he didn't know about the Sea King, you could write on the back of a postage stamp with a big thick felt pen. I mean, he was just a brilliant man. We call him the professor. And I'll name him Ian White, Chief Pet Officer Ian White. He was as sick as a dog every single day at sea. He had the bucket with the damp cloth on top of it next to his seat. And he simply suffered for months. And he was a very, very hefty and, yeah, he was a very considerable man to do that. And quite hard work. Yeah, I mean, there were plenty of people who felt
I never imagined someone who's prone to seasickness volunteering to join the Navy. For some reason, it just seems like a bad idea. But
you kind of don't know until you do it, you know?
And I suppose by then you're already in, and it's just much of a hassle to change.
Yeah, Prince Charles was. In fact, most people on the Minesweeper Squadron's first day out were sick because they really used to, you know, ton-class boats used to bounce around horrifically. You know, the big ships weren't so bad, there's some books have been published about how it's very difficult for them on board and Hermes didn't like them. I can only speak for Invincible. Invincible was a happy and harmonious place to do naval aviation. We did a lot of it. And I think you had to be, because of our very small flight deck, you simply had to, you know, I remember one particular day, things were getting very difficult. The Sea Harriers were interfering with everything I wanted to do, and I felt I should get more priority, and I started shouting a bit. And I was simply taken aside by an older and bolder lieutenant, said, "Steve, mate, dial it back. It's not going to get you what you want. Nobody thinks it's smart. Dial it back." And that business of gelling as a team, you know, is so important. And the point about naval aviation is to execute naval aviation in that way, you have to work that team up, right from the guy who's serving you an egg, a butty down in the aircrew refreshment bar, all the way up to the pilot who's strapping himself in, and the people on the radars, and the guys labouring down in the magazines to get the weapons up, and the people trying to get the spares up, the people working the lifts, and all those people, everybody has to work as a team. And it's a great joy when you see it at close quarters being done well. And I had the privilege to see that. It's one thing I would like to offer is one thing you've not mentioned, which I think is exceptionally good of you, is of course we had His Royal Highness, Prince Andrew, was a pilot on our squadron.
That's mainly I haven't answered that. I hadn't asked that yet because I hadn't worked out a very cool coach way to ask that question, but right. Please carry on.
Okay, well, the only reason I bring it up is there's a very, very important point I'd like to put over. Is that people, again, will choose not to believe this. He had very, very few examples of special treatment. Prince Charles, for instance, because he was first in line to the throne, he'd had the Red Dragon fight with two specially prepared aircraft, the aircraft prepared to royal standards and all that sort of thing. Prince Andrew had none of that. There were a couple of restrictions on what he could do, but I'm here to tell your listeners that these were down in the fur. He couldn't do search and check test flights at night, but as he was only a P2 at that point, as a P2 he probably wouldn't have been doing them. He was very much one of the crew. He was a very good, I will say this, and I'm happy to say this, he was a very good P2. In time, he became a very, very good P1. He was a very good, in my direct experience, he was a very good officer. Mm-hmm. Took good care of his men, was thoughtful, and did a good job. And that was it. One of the more surreal moments I had in a couple of years after war was a bunch of people writing a book about the Falklands, and the chap said, "Oh well, you know, of course we know which one of your aircraft were Prince Andrew's," aircraft, you see. And I said, no, he didn't have any special aircraft. He said, oh, no, he did. And because I had the white, the serial numbers were left painted white. And I said, yeah, all the serial numbers were left painted white. He said, oh, no. He said, we know that he had two special aircraft. And I said, but he didn't. Oh, no, he did. And it's at that point you realise it was some people you just have to give up. And it is
a question. Surely the engineering officer who is looking after the aircraft would know if he has a special aircraft.
I probably would have done. It's also fair to point out, and he's never made a big thing about it, that one of the things we did was we carried around a big bag of chaff in the back of the aircraft. We didn't have any chaff dispensers or anything like that. So in the event of an Exocet attack, the closest seeking to the ship had to get at a certain position relative to the ship at a certain height, and the air crewman would start throwing bundles of chaff out the back door in the hope of seducing an Exocet missile away. It was purely his bad luck that I know he did that at least twice and probably three times, but it was purely he had the bad luck to be in an aircraft close into the ship when these various exercises, when these various occurrences took place.
Seriously, it's the Invincible class. I always thought this myself when they were first built, and I, to an extent, feel this about the Queen Elizabeth's. Seems to be not enough, a lot's been focused on their primary mission, and that's very good, but not enough being focused about the fact that these are actually vessels which are going into war and should have a measure of self-defense.
Well,
I know they had the sea darts on the Invincible.
Oh, yeah, we did.
But that's not really what a carrier needs.
We had pretty good...
Crewdeck cruiser, as it was.
Good chaff launchers on board, and the... In fact, ESMEW kit wasn't bad for its day. But it's fair to say that, like a lot of navies in the world, well, not like all navies, we pretty much neglected layered air defence and close-in weapons systems. Of course, that was on that ship. We always had a goalkeeper, which was a Type 22 frigate, no more than 400 yards from us all the time, armed with, of course, the seawall system, which was exceptionally brilliant and a very, very good system indeed. World-beating system then, a world-beating system now. So we were able to make do with what we'd done. But yeah, you're right to observe that there were elements of the close-in defence that we weren't incredibly well prepared for. And of course, it had been, you know, as I said a long while ago now, it's years and years and years since we fought a shooting war. So a lot of the old lessons about flooding and fire damage had all been forgotten. And the Invincibles have been built down to a cost. So on the way down to Ascension, I vividly remember the smell of welding and burning and cutting as extra fire branch pipes were welded in and extra firefighting stations were built. And of course, Sheffield got hit, and the instructions for the smoke curtains, I remember, appeared 3 days after Sheffield went down. We had signals coming out with word, you know, faxes were saying, and we were set to making curtains to try to hold the spread of smoke, which had been such a big factor in losing the Sheffield. The thing nobody expected, you know, was the smoke. So, the Navy was learning a lot. I think the advantage is that the Royal Navy, for its faults, is usually a very quick learner. And we were doing a lot of stuff down there to keep up with it.
And, well, I suppose this is the point to ask this question. So, what lessons did you learn during the war that you would have liked to have known before the war began and that you think people going in your position should know today?
That's a really, really good question. What would I have liked to know before? I think I'd have liked to have known... Does that sound really... We were exceptionally well prepared. And really and truly, there weren't many humongous surprises jumping out at me in my position. Because our squadron was so well led, they shielded us from a lot of that. So they were giving us jobs we could do all the time. So in that respect, those lessons weren't so. I think, certainly, the business about doing what we did for so many days, 79 days we flew continuously for. I think the main thing I had to learn that I didn't know when I went there was about conserving your people, was about the man management aspects. So I had ideas of how the watch would run, and I very quickly had to learn that it wasn't going to run like that at all. But again, one of the things is that your watch chief, your watch controllers, these are guys who are carefully chosen while they're on the squadron. And they are highly experienced and very good chiefs. And if they're not, you get rid of them, you get another watch controller in as quick as you can. And they took a lot of the credit for making it work. The other kind of interesting thing, the lesson that I learned was the importance of the way our particular engineering group worked was that we had myself and the assistant were 8 hours on, 8 hours off, just crunching the watches. Backing us up and supervising us was the aircraft engineering officer and the senior maintenance rating. I've not mentioned him much, but he did a pivotal job. Those two were working days, and they were basically solving our problems before they came to us. So they were making a lot of the longer term decisions on the aircraft. They were down there sorting out the problems during the day that I didn't have time to, because I was running around on a flight deck with my hair on fire. They were, the thing I learned that I didn't know was actually how that squadron structure would work in that intense, prolonged period of activity. And when the time came for me to train aircraft engineers as they went through for their certificate of competency, this was a scenario I always threw at them and said, okay, what are you going to do? How do you do it? And try and get them to think about, you know, the limits of people and understanding that some people can work long hours and some people can't. And you have to build that team. And that, I think, was probably a key lesson that I learned that I didn't know, was just how important that was. You know, I think in these days where we think that war's highly technical and driven by intelligence and, you know, ones and zeros and bits and bytes, we forget that in the middle of it all are people. And those people have to be led and managed and nurtured and consoled and told and ordered and listened to and spoken to. And you have to, and that's such an important component of it. And that's the thing I would say probably that I learned more of. Of course, it didn't make me much better as an officer, but I was certainly, to quote the old thing, I was none the wiser, but I was certainly better informed. Let's put it like that way.
That's good. Thank you. And before we finish, anything you would like to add from the Falklands War? Any experiences you would like to share that we haven't already discussed?
I would end on a difficult note. When we went ashore to Port Stanley, the place was an utter nightmare. It was literally strewn with the detritus of war, literally hundreds of anti-tank missiles unused spewing out of boxes. I mean, I actually do remember wading through a drift of unused bullets, piles of rifles everywhere, ammunition, you know, they had built revetments out of boxes containing 155mm artillery shells, but they hadn't taken the artillery shells out of the boxes. You know, so they built revetments out of live ammunition. But while we were clearing some items around the race course, we stumbled on some bodies. And they were young southern Argentinian lads. We knew that from the papers that we found scattered around them. And they'd been killed outright by artillery blasts. And I shall never forget the feeling of sadness, of you know, in spite of everything that we'd achieved and how good the war had been for my squadron and how much we'd gained from it, I still occasionally have that vision, that sight in my head of those young bodies so far from home for no good reason at all. And just a real determination that whatever the armed forces can do to prevent that, to convince people that it's not going to be worth it. Perhaps it's a forlorn hope, but if you're asking the most intense thing, I think that was probably it. And actually, to end on a good note, was our return. You may have seen some of the films of Invincible coming back. The thing that your listeners may not believe is we had absolutely no idea that was going to happen. We had absolutely no idea. We really didn't expect very much. We thought people would be tired and bored of it by that at that time. We really did. And as the fog lifted on the morning we were steaming in, there was just thousands of small boats coming out to meet us. And of course we had the Royal Family on board, and that had been kept very, very low key, and we had the whole of the Royal Family on board. And I think, yeah, coming alongside with that huge crowd and spotting my wife and going down the gangway to meet her, I think, yeah, if you're asking for a Falklands experience, yeah, I think that was the one. That was the one.
Well, thank you.
That's a pleasure. Amazing.
Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much for taking the time to listen to this podcast. I hope you found it as useful as I found it enjoyable to record. If you haven't already listened to the first batch, please go take a listen to them. They're excellent as well. I know that I'm biased, but they are. And please stay tuned for the next installments of Dispatch. Have a nice evening.